Available now from Graphic Audio.
Tell me, Kip, if you've done bad things your whole life, but you die doing something good, do you think that makes up for all the bad?
No.
Me neither.
But it's better than nothing. Orcholum is merciful.
Wonder if you'll say that after they're done with your village.
Gavin Guile is the Prism, the most powerful man in the world. He is High Priest and Emperor, a man whose power, wit, and charm are all that preserves a tenuous peace. A peace that is slowly rotting from the inside out.
This is all that's left of what was once a great civilization. Statues of great men, broken by the pygmies who followed. Let me tell you something you already know. Something that all of you have believed, but no one dared to say. The wrong Guile won the Prism's war. They killed him because they were worried he would change everything. They feared him because Dazen Guile wanted to free us. Dazen knew that light cannot be changed.
As darkness slowly encroaches upon the land, Gavin receives a mysterious letter.
I'm dying, Gavin. It's time you meet your son, Kip. Lena.
As Gavin races to find his son, he learns of a new and dangerous threat to his empire. A man who calls himself King.
Your time is finished. Yours and the Chromarians. You're done! Light cannot be chained. Know this, Prism. We will take back what you've stolen. The horrors of your reign are almost at an end. And when it ends, I will be there. This I swear!
With the death of his empire looming, Gavin will be forced to wage a war on multiple fronts. But little does he know, his assassin may be looking right before his very eyes.
You're a stupid, stupid boy, Kip. But maybe a dull sword can go where a sharp one wouldn't be allowed. Don't you forget this. Don't listen to him, you hear me? He's a liar. You will not fail me in this, Kip. You learn, and then you kill him.
Yes, Mother?
Kip, if you ever loved me, avenge me. Swear it by your worthless soul, Kip.
I swear to avenge you, Mother, by my very soul.
Don't miss the beginning of the end in Brent Week's critically acclaimed new series, The Lightbringer Trilogy. Book 1, The Black Prism, Parts 1 through 3. Available now in Graphic Audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terrence Azelford. With performances by Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, Dylan Lynch, Tony Nam, M.B. Van Dorn, Ren Casey, David Coyne, Stephen Carpenter, Elizabeth Jernigan, and Mort Shelby. Survivalist number 27, Death Watch. John Thomas Rourke raised the two pistols in his hands, bringing them to eye level. They were the Lancer copies of the Sig Sauer P-228 from the days before the night of the war. He wore not his customary dark-lensed aviator-style sunglasses, but gray-lensed shooting glasses instead, earmuffs as well. This was an indoor range within the very bowels of the submersible carrier Paladin, the facility for the use of the Paladin security forces and whatever Navy SEAL detachments might from time to time be stationed aboard. As he began firing the matching 9mm Parabellums, a bizarre parallel crossed Rourke's mind. The guns were so identical to the originals that they were like clones. And he lived because of a clone, the clone's heart beating now within his chest. That was 19 days ago, when the heart was placed within him. Even before the night of the war, he could have been up and around, capable of limited activity by now. But with the fantastic strides made by modern medicine 625 years in the objective future from the date of the Great Conflagration, he was fully restored. Indeed, the heart which had been given him was stronger, newer than his own, albeit an identical tissue match. People lived considerably longer these days, and he had spent more than six centuries in cryogenic sleep, which also lent itself to heightened longevity. The new heart, his surgeon had told him, would add years to his lifespan. That was ironic. There was in process a limited nuclear war between the Transglobal Alliance and the Nation of Eden and its ally, the Nazis, under the leadership of Dietrich Zimmer. And according to the best scientific data available, the suboceanic rift in the Pacific Basin was still progressing inexorably toward the North American continental plate. Once it reached that plate, there existed the almost certain likelihood that the rift would split along the edge of the plate and precipitate the eventual eruption of all major volcanoes comprising the Ring of Fire, forming a caldera of biblical proportions, eventually destroying the planet. Life expectancy was all a matter of perspective. If the war with the Nazis could be brought to a swift conclusion, and the nuclear weapons in the Eden and Nazi arsenals, along with those of the new United States and new Germany, could be utilized, it was theoretically possible to save the planet from destruction. The nuclear weapons, the preponderance of them and the tactical yield range, could be used to relieve the pressure on the volcanic vent and avert catastrophic eruption. It was the choice toward which the nuclear age had propelled itself since its very dawning. Would mankind use nuclear weapons to end the Earth? The irony was that mankind, if the option of self-destruction were not elected, might use nuclear weapons to save the Earth. Rourke left the slides of the two 228s locked open, the electronic display beside him revealing the exact positioning of each of the hits on the target. He had blown out the center of mass kill zone. He set down the pistols, picking up the little Detonics Combat Masters, which he had used since before the night of the war. At the next position, Annie was finishing a ridiculously slow string with her Detonic Scoremaster. As she lowered her pistol, its action locked open over the empty magazine, she turned toward him, smiling. Through the transparent divider, Rourke could see the electronic posting of her hit.
Very funny.
She had shot a Valentine heart shape over the heart of the silhouette. Annie Rourke Rubenstein was pleased with her shooting, but even more pleased that her father seemed relaxed. Difficult times lay ahead of him, and although the doctors were proclaiming that he was sounder than he had ever been, she still worried. Annie sometimes wondered if it was part of the job description which went with being a woman, official worrier. Her father continued shooting, burning through previously loaded magazines with a vengeance. He had always enjoyed shooting as a means of relaxation, and she smiled bitterly, remembering. She retained the faintest memories of her mother and father arguing once. She imagined it had been more often than that, about her father taking Michael out to do some shooting.
Why would you put a gun in a little boy's hand, for God's sake?
Because Michael won't always be a little boy, Sarah. As a man, he'll be well served knowing how to use firearms. And it isn't any male thing. As soon as Annie's a little older...
Oh, you're obsessed with guns, John.
Annie's mother still adamantly believed that her father was the man behind the gun that night at Eden, when, in reality, Dietrich Zimmer had done the foul deed of shooting Sarah Rourke in the head. It wasn't her mother's fault that she blamed her husband instead of the real culprit, but that didn't make living with the situation any easier. Whether Emma Shaw's eyes were opened or closed, she could still recall the image of the dead clone of John Rourke almost as vividly as the wild look in Sarah Rourke's eyes when Sarah had killed the clone in a vain attempt to kill John. Sarah had known full well that the clone was the clone, not John, but also known full well that by killing the clones, she had tried to stab the heart, she would kill John. The ship psychiatrist, Commander Donald Blankenship, had requested that Emma come to see him, as a sort of mental debriefing. She could have refused, but on the plus side, talking about it with a disinterested party might do her some good. Emma had guilt feelings as the other woman, the homewrecker, even though she knew that nothing she had done had precipitated what had happened. The time was right for the mental debriefing, too, because tonight there would be dinner, then retiring early in order to be ready for the pre-dawn flight, which would take them, John, his daughter Annie, and Emma herself, to Lidveldet Island, where, if all went according to plan, there would be a neutral ground meeting with the one man in the world with whose help mankind might be able to save the planet from almost certain cataclysm. There would be no time, in either event, survival or death, for recriminations, nor time to waste in other ways. If she and John could somehow survive, they would marry after Sarah, if indeed Sarah really was Sarah, had divorced him. They both expected that to be an ordeal, considering Sarah's current mental state. She remembered what John had told her, lying beside her in her bunk on the first night after his release from the ship's sickbay.
I knew people who became embroiled in divorce. It was a common malady in the 20th century. I suppose that's one reason I fought so hard to keep this from happening, because I believed that if I fought hard enough, I could prevent it. The doctors say that Sarah's fine in every other respect, that on a rational basis, she'll eventually accept as fact that it was Dietrich Zimmer who shot her, not me. But she can't forgive the death of Martin or his clone. That she'll never forgive. But it wasn't working anyway, and sometimes you get so tired that you can't endure any longer. She'll be happier with Wolfgang.
Then he folded his right arm around her and went to sleep. She hadn't wanted him to make love to her, just to hold her, and he understood that. It was several more days before she felt that he was well enough so that they could make love, even though the doctors had pronounced him 90% recovered. But she wondered now if she had merely been using his recovery as an excuse. That for centuries, John Rourke had been all but celibate would be unimaginable to someone who knew him only sexually. He was beyond terrific in bed, almost beyond human. But John was born for monogamy. While there was a chance that his and Sarah's marriage might be saved, John remained faithful to his wife. Emma Shaw knew that John had crossed a bridge on which he could never return when he made love to her that first time. For the last three nights, they had been lovers again. John's stamina was beyond question, but the guilt which she felt, however unjustified she knew it to be from a rational point of view, could someday interfere. She didn't want that. Perhaps the Paladin's shrink could help against that. Perhaps not. She would wait and see. Commander Blankenship entered his office, smiled, and sat down behind his desk, and apologized.
Even psychiatrists have emergencies now and again. Should have been a dermatologist. They get some too, though.
No problem, Commander.
Don, please. May I call you Emma?
Sure.
You have a lot ahead of you, I understand. Isn't that so, Emma?
I hope so.
What I meant was, you have a lot of responsibilities as a naval officer and as a woman. Hasn't been easy for you, I imagine, this whole thing with Dr. Rourke's near death, your own encounter with the would-be assassin, and then...
I'm holding off, Don, on whether I want psychoanalysis or not. But no, it hasn't been easy. Let me settle a few things. I'm the other woman in this whole thing, and even if I didn't think of myself that way, everyone else probably does. Sarah Rourke's a living legend, a role model to women everywhere. As a little girl, when you read about Sarah Rourke in the history books, you don't picture her trying to stab to death a clone of her husband so that she can ensure his death. So, yeah, it was a little unsettling to say the least. When I was a little girl, I read about Sarah Rourke and thought, wow, What a courageous woman to do all that stuff, you know? And none of that's lost. She's still one of the finest women in history for my money. But then here I am, the homewrecker. I know on a rational basis that I'm not responsible, that John and his wife would have broken up anyway. But her trying to kill him because Dietrich Zimmer implanted a memory in her brain that never took place is tough to deal with. Why don't you answer one question for me?
If I can, Emma.
What can be done for Sarah Rourke? I know that you've spoken with her several times over the last 2.5 weeks, but does it look like she'll be able to be convinced about the memory Zimmer put into her head?
I don't suppose I'm betraying the doctor-patient confidentiality by telling you. Sarah Rourke knows now, on a rational basis, that her husband never attempted to kill her. If you feel some guilt in your self-described role as the perceived homewrecker, you can imagine the guilt she feels. Considerably more genuine, more reality-based about killing the clone of Dr. Rourke in an attempt to prevent the heart transplant which saved Dr. Rourke's life. Mrs. Rourke will have a tough time dealing with that, and for a lot longer than your misgiving should endure. But the memory is still there, however false the memory is, coloring her perceptions. There's nothing we can do to eradicate that memory entirely. I can bury it through hypnosis, so it's much less close to the surface, but that won't rid her of it. And she still blames Dr. Rourke for the death of their son, Martin. Even if, in fact, the man Dr. Rourke thought was Martin was really a clone. And she knows that's an irrational position, but that doesn't alter the fact that she perceives what Dr. Rourke did as wrong. Actually, you were quite right in what you said a moment ago, that you are not responsible for the dissolution of their marriage. It's obvious that their marriage ceased functioning as anything more than something to be tolerated years ago, long before the night of the war. I'd say she needs to start over again, just like Dr. Rourke himself needs to. She told me yesterday, Mrs. Rourke did, that she hopes things work out for you and Dr. Rourke. That's the real reason I called you in this morning. She asked if I'd tell you because she doesn't want to see you at this juncture, nor see John Rourke.
John feels the same. I mean about Sarah and Wolfgang Mann getting together. They still love each other, the Rourkes.
Oh, I agree, Emma. Maybe that's what makes the fact that their marriage is dead so sad.
Emma Shaw glanced at her wristwatch. Fortunately, she was running late and had to get out of there. If she talked about this much longer, she'd cry. James Darkwood sat behind the wheel of the electric car, all lights in the vehicle out. The road toward which Michael sometimes stared was little-traveled, Cronenberg had told them, perfect for their rendezvous. Michael wouldn't allow its perfection until after Cronenberg had joined them and they were underway, perhaps not even until they had reached the airfield. This was the heart of Cronenberg's operation, his own personal fiefdom within the Nazi Empire. Once, before the night of the war, when the then-existing West Coast disappeared into the sea, this had been Klamath Falls, Oregon. Now it was disputed Eden territory and one of the principal North American seaports on the Pacific. Unlike New Reno in Nevada, this was not an open port, but fully Nazi-dominated. It was called New Hamburg. Before Darkwood had left with Paul Rubinstein, Natalia had imparted some advice.
Remember that any rendezvous in enemy territory, or for that matter, any rendezvous at all, can be compromised. If the three of you wait, just as you've been told, you will all run the risk of death or worse.
That, and common sense, was why James Darkwood waited alone in the car and Michael and Paul waited well away from it, both of them black-clad against the darkness and armed as heavily as they could be against whatever might happen. Michael looked at his watch. Cronenberg would be late in 2 minutes. The three of them had agreed that if Cronenberg were more than 1 minute late, the rendezvous would be broken off and they would get out. If that happened, the meeting would have to be reset, because the chance which a temporary alliance with Cronenberg presented could not be dismissed. It was perhaps the only chance for mankind's survival. Cronenberg wanted to depose Dietrich Zimmer and Martin Rourke Zimmer, thus enabling himself to seize command of Nazi forces and the country of Eden. Any alliance would indeed be temporary, because if Cronenberg succeeded in attaining the power he sought, he would eventually have to be dealt with. Perhaps that was the true lesson of history. that the world would never be a perfect place, and that there would always be strife, at least as long as mankind survived. Only a little over a minute remained before their rendezvous, and as yet, there were no signs of headlights coming down the road. Paul Rubenstein shifted position slightly, his right leg starting to fall asleep. He moved very slowly in case he was being watched. Available to him were night vision goggles, but he couldn't risk them now, so close to the time of the rendezvous. Even though they would automatically filter the headlights, his true night vision would be gone for several seconds afterward. Those could be deadly seconds. Paul's position was on the far side of the road, almost directly opposite the automobile in which James Darkwood sat alone. He glanced at his watch. About 30 seconds until Gruppenführer Otto Kroenberg was due. Either Kroenberg had precisely worked out the driving time to the last second, or Kroenberg was late. That could mean betrayal by Kroenberg himself, or that Kroenberg's desire to depose Zimmer had somehow been discovered and that Kroenberg himself was compromised. Waiting in pitch darkness in the heart of enemy territory for a Nazi to arrive for a friendly chat was not Paul Rubinstein's idea of fun. Nazis had killed too many of his relatives during World War II, slaughtering them just because they were Jewish. But Otto Kroenberg might, in an odd way, be mankind's salvation, if Kroenberg's immediate goals to depose the current Nazi leadership sufficiently coincided with those of the Trans-Global Alliance. If Kroenberg came to power and surrendered the nuclear weapons, which would then come under his control, at least any conflict between the world's current superpowers would be non-nuclear. Such was little consolation. But at this stage, grasping at straws was better than despair. Just as Paul Rubinstein was about to give up on the rendezvous, headlights appeared in the distance. Indeed, the road was little traveled, just as Kroenberg had told James Darkwood that it would be. Odds were high that the car was Kroenberg's, but nearly as high that this was the opening gambit of a trap. Aside from his chauffeur, Max, in the front seat, and the girl who sat beside him in the back seat, Kroenberg was alone, as he had promised. Max was expected, but Helga was not. It was doubtful that the Allied agents who awaited him out there in the darkness would kill Helga, but he would not be terribly dismayed if they did. Helga was a warm, very well-put-together, blonde-headed body virtually poured into a pink mini-dress. Excellent in bed, she was, nonetheless, wholly expendable.
Otto, just wherever are we going?
On a little trip, my dear. You brought that nice warm coat that I gave you?
Uh-huh.
Good. Now be quiet for a moment, Helga.
Helga drew back into the far corner of the seat as Kroenberg reached under the civilian jacket which he wore and touched the butt of his pistol. It was a Lancer copy of the Walther P-38, the most accurate pistol he had ever owned, and wholly functionally reliable. He slipped the pistol free from its shoulder holster, his right thumb resting beneath the slide-mounted thumb safety, ready to flick it upward into the fire position. The automobile's headlights, as they came out of the gentle curve, picked up the reflection of another, smaller car on the left side of the road. That would be the American Naval Intelligence Agent James Darkwood. It was too bad that Darkwood was so dedicated and anti-Nazi. Kroenberg would have hired the fellow.
Max?
Gruppenführer.
Be prepared to stop the vehicle when I order, and do nothing unless I say that you should.
Jawohl, Gruppenführer Kroenberg.
Otto?
Not now, Helga. Just be silent. Now, Max, stop the automobile now.
Jawohl, Gruppenführer.
Now, Max, you will dim, then raise your headlights three times in rapid succession. This is understood?
Jawohl, Gruppenführer.
The headlights on the smaller car came on high beam.
Gruppenführer.
It should be all right, Max. Wait in the car. All is in order, Helga. Wait here and remain silent.
Natalia Anastasia Temerovna raised her glass as John Rourke completed the toast.
And whatever happens, this glass is raised to us, all of us. Those who are here seated around this table, and those who are not.
Natalia drank down the wine, as did Annie, Emma Shaw, and John Rourke himself. And her thoughts were shared, she knew, with the others, except perhaps for Emma. Emma would think of Michael, of Paul, of Sarah, too. But Natalia remembered one other whom Emma had never met, who was gone from their company for a very long time. Her name was Madison Rourke, Michael's deceased first wife. Natalia would be Michael's second wife, and live or die, she knew that she and Michael would endure for eternity together.
I want to say that we're a family, just as we have always been. What has happened with my mother doesn't change any of that. So I think we should each have another glass of wine, Daddy, and toast Emma, our newest member.
Hear, hear! To Emma, with love from her family!
Emma Shaw felt so embarrassed that, were there a hole, she would have crawled inside of it. John reached out and touched Emma's hand on the table beside him. Natalia looked at Annie and winked. John refilled the wine glasses for the other two women and herself. Annie raised her glass.
To Emma, then.
To Emma.
James Darkwood drove, Paul Rubinstein sitting beside him in the front passenger seat of the little electric car. Kroenberg sat in back, Michael beside him. The chauffeur, Max, and a woman who looked like the perfect caricature of an airhead from a Hollywood movie, but a voluptuous one to be sure, were on their way again. Kroenberg was to be gone for 36 hours on a little weekend trip with the woman. Her name was never given. Paul Rubinstein secretly wondered if Max the chauffeur and the woman would have a good time together. James Darkwood interrupted Paul's thoughts.
We've got somebody behind us, following with the lights off.
Shit.
Indeed. None of my personnel are to be anywhere near here, which means, of course, that the car is driven by some innocent who is too stupid to notice that his or her lights aren't on. There is a brilliant moon, after all. Or that Dr. Zimmer's intelligence agents are keeping a closer watch over me than I had supposed.
We should assume the latter. Would they merely follow, or would they report in at this stage?
They would not report in for fear that any radio message might be intercepted by my own personnel. The structure of Dr. Zimmer's empire is something all of you should bear in mind. Dr. Zimmer is a leader without a country, and so we occupy little places, fiefdoms, as it were, controlled by the local leadership. This area is mine. Being the doctor's enemy, I have taken certain steps to safeguard such things as communication security. And he knows that I am his enemy, yet can do nothing at this juncture for fear of upsetting the delicate balance within his high command.
It's rather like Hitler's relationship with his general staff, isn't it?
In that case, I suppose that I would be best compared to Admiral Canaris.
Okay, I've heard the name, but why was Canaris special?
He smuggled Jews out of Germany. But I think Lieutenant General Kroenberg is referring to Canaris actively using German intelligence to contravene Hitler's wishes.
He fought against the less-than-able man in his own way, as I do.
For more heroic reasons, though, I suspect. Or at least less selfish ones.
You will achieve your purpose, perhaps, and I will achieve mine. That is the essence of a bargain, James.
Darkwood didn't answer. Paul was looking in the side-view mirror.
I think we're gonna have to do something about these guys. If they don't get the idea that something's fishy when they see us rendezvous with an aircraft, they'll have to be too stupid even for Nazis. No offense, Kroenberg.
You detest my very existence, Herr Rubinstein, because I am a Nazi. I harbor the same animosity toward you because you are a Jew. How little the human species has improved in the last 6 centuries. Would you not agree, Herr Rubinstein?
I do indeed agree, Kroenberg.
James, why not speed up a little? If the car behind us should be innocent, we'll lose them. If not, we'll reach the rendezvous point for the aircraft a little early. Early enough to nail these guys before the plane arrives.
Good idea, Michael.
You have a weapon?
Of course, Herr Rubinstein.
Good. Maybe you need it. When we reach the rendezvous, James, you take the car on past. Stop only long enough for us to get out without breaking an ankle. Michael, you ride with James for about 100 yards or so to get out. Find some cover and be ready. Kroenberg and I'll stick together. And James, you drive on for about another half mile, then double back. When the car that's following us comes in sight, we catch it between us. Got any objections to shooting other Nazis, Kroenberg?
Only certain Nazis, my Jewish friend.
One other thing. I'm not your friend.
The officer's lounge had sort of become their place for a drink, a smoke, a little talk. Emma Shaw sat on the same bar stool that she'd occupied when John had first asked to make love to her.
I spoke with a psychiatrist. He told me to call him Don.
Uh-huh. What did Don say?
That Sarah wishes us the best. Happiness. And that she knows on a rational basis that you never shot her, even though the memory Dietrich Zimmer implanted is still there.
Don was the messenger. And did he say anything else, Emma?
He told me I shouldn't feel like a homewrecker. But I already knew that, and it doesn't help.
And?
I love you.
and want to be with you forever, longer than that. I'll get used to the fact that none of this was anybody's fault. You know what I mean? That I'll get used to the fact that there's nothing to feel guilty about.
I know what you mean.
How are you feeling?
What? You mean my heart? It's still beating. I just wish there'd been another way.
So it does bother you, the death of the clone?
Oh, yeah.
But if one of your family or...
For you? Remember what Annie and Natalia said? That you were part of the family? They were right. What you're asking, though, is if one of the family were dying and I could kill a clone in order to salvage a heart or whatever, which could keep the original person, the real one, alive, would I do it?
Yes, John. I know the answer, so don't waste your breath telling me something different.
Would I murder someone to save my family? Of course I would. But that doesn't make it right. That clone of me, like the ones that Paul was forced to kill with Darkwood's help at Zimmer's base in the Himalayas, they were all living, and being clones of us didn't change that. They could have experienced life just like you, just like me, just like the originals. I'm alive because another man is dead.
Uncomfortable feeling, yeah. There was this girl in my squadron a couple of years ago. Her name was Angie. We were in a dogfight with some Eden fighter bombers over the Tuamotu archipelago, about 10 degrees south, below the Marquesas a little. One of my missiles malfunctioned and stayed half in the rack, throwing me out of trim and just about to blow. The whole wing was going up in flames. I had to eject.
And?
Well, Angie and the rest of the guys in the squadron took out the enemy aircraft. But Angie stayed around, overflying my position on the water, taking pot shots at sharks, waiting there until the rescue chopper could get in and pick me up. It was 2 hours. We were in radio contact. I ordered her away, because I knew she was running low on fuel. She refused to obey my orders, though. She just stayed there. Finally, just about the time she was starting to run on vapor, the rescue chopper showed up. I radioed Angie that she should ditch, because the plane would never make it anywhere. Nearest carrier was about 15 minutes past her maximum fuel time. She laughed, I remember, telling me that she wasn't any hero, that she was going to ditch even if I hadn't told her. They could take the plane out of her salary, $5 a week.
She was a brave woman.
Was. She hit the silk, but she was lower on fuel than she'd let on, or than she realized. Just as she ejected, the plane's burners cut out, and the aircraft intersected her trajectory and...
I love you.
I'm not gonna lie, that's a really weird fucking segue, John. I mean, my friend. She died, John. She's dead. Go, fuck it. I love you too.
The gun in Otto Kroenberg's right hand was clearly visible beneath the bright moon, the classic lines of the Walther P-38 unmistakable. The P-38 was adopted by Nazi forces in 1938, serving as military standard during World War II, and then redesignated the P-1 except for civilian sales, and incorporating an alloy frame, it was used by West German forces until relatively few years before the night of the war.
Alloy frame?
Yes. Most of the best 9mm parabellums have alloy frames.
Paul Rubinstein felt himself smiling again, despite the nature of the man. Kroenberg most probably knew that he, Paul Rubinstein, carried a Browning High Power, which had a steel frame.
Yeah, mine's more durable. John Rourke told me that the FBI, the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation, used high powers for the hostage rescue unit personnel for quite a long time, before the night of the war, getting upwards of 40,000 rounds out of each gun.
Touché, Herr Rubinstein. Your penile member is officially as big as mine.
Michael had to be in position by now, and the pursuit car was coming, slowing tentatively. The open field where the V-stall would land for the rendezvous in under 5 minutes was to the left side of the road. Paul and Kroenberg hid there in high brush, concealed but with minimal cover from low, sculpted pieces of concrete, the remnants of some pre-war structural foundation. On the far side of the road was where Michael would have taken up position. The electric car, with James Darkwood behind the wheel, was out of sight now. Paul Rubinstein drew back the bolt of the Schmeisser submachine gun. The pursuit car was nearly even with their position.
I find it amusing that a Jew was using an MP-40 submachine gun, a staple of the heroic soldiers of the Reich who guarded the camps where your people were housed.
I find it amusing that you're talking about irrelevant bullshit when we're about to kill a whole bunch of people.
The pursuit car was dead even with them now.
We shoot out the tires and see what happens.
Agreed.
Paul rose from their meager cover, the MP40's shoulder stock extended, the butt plate tight against him as he aimed at the driver's side tires. The car skidded across into the oncoming lane, shuddering to a halt. Kronberg was up in a low crouch, moving forward. Paul Rubinstein fanned right, coming up on the car by staying just behind it, the Schmeisser trained on the driver's side doors. But as he advanced, he could still see the passenger side.
Be ready.
Michael would be closing in, but still staying to cover, his M16 ready. The driver's door opened, and a man in a dark, high-collared jacket in the old Nehru look and a cap reminiscent of those worn by Greek fishermen before the night of the war stepped out.
Bitte! English! Please, what is this?
Keep your hands up.
Yes!
The man in the funny, stylish clothes threw himself down behind the door.
Look out!
Paul dived left and down as the rear window of the pursuit car shattered outward. Paul returned fire.
Watch out behind you, Joe!
Paul Rubinstein rolled left as his eyes came online with the road surface, again seeing a second car, its bright lights cutting on, the car picking up speed, careening toward them. It sounded like Michael had joined the fight, but Paul Rubinstein couldn't be sure, and there was no time to look toward the source of the sound. He was on his knees now, stabbing the nearly spent subgun toward the headlights. The car swerved, bouncing across the ditch at the side of the road and disappearing into the trees. Paul threw himself down and into a roll, coming up to face the original car still behind him. Michael Rourke's assault rifle was spitting flame in the darkness.
Kronberg, help Michael!
I'm on my last magazine, Joe!
Paul rammed a fresh magazine into the Schmeisser. His submachine gun in his right fist, the battered old Browning high power in his left, Paul advanced on the second car.
Get up after me as soon as you can!
Of course!
Paul broke into a run, leaving the road, reaching the tree line, stopping beside a tall, thin-trunked pine. The car was in sight, but that was no reason to suppose that whoever had been in the car was nice enough to wait there for him. Turning toward the sound, Paul saw Kronberg. Kronberg dropped to his knees beside another tree.
Michael Rourke is guarding the road. There were two occupants of the first car, the driver and the one who fired through the window. You killed the driver, Michael Rourke killed the other one. I can move around to the far side of the car.
Bad idea. It works great in vid movies and books, but if you get opposite me and I have to shoot, I might hit you. Now, we stay together. I lead, you cover my back.
And what if I decide that the world could use one less Jew right now?
My brother-in-law Michael would rip your lungs out. Satisfactory answer?
For the moment, Jew.
Cover me and stay close.
Paul started moving slowly to his left. Since the vast majority of men were right-handed and would hold or control a pistol or rifle with the right hand, it was always wise to move to the left, the prospective shooter's right, since the body could more naturally turn in the direction away from the hand controlling the weapon, especially if one's enemy were in any position other than standing. Kronberg behind him, Paul Rubinstein moved as silently as he could, still staying as close to what meager cover there was in case he needed it in a hurry. As best Paul Rubinstein could tell, the V-stall should be arriving at any second. If the occupants of the second car were somehow able to fire at the V-stall, damaging it or forcing it to flee, he and Michael and James Darkwood and Kronberg would be stuck here in territory growing more hostile by the second. Annie Rourke Rubinstein and Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna entered the officer's lounge as Annie's father and Emma Shaw left, stopping with them for a moment and talking, watching them as they walked off together.
To her cabin or his?
Annie, that's your dad!
Annie and Natalia walked together to the bar. Natalia, as usual, looked perfect and elegant, but in a way that was so wonderfully natural. She wore heels, tailored black beltless slacks, and a gray silk blouse open to her cleavage, with long full sleeves and high button cuffs. Her only jewelry was a simple gold chain, small gold earrings, each in the shape of a just-blossomed rose, and her Rolex with the Jubilee band.
How many weapons do you have?
Despite the ship's regulations, all of them were armed.
I must be getting old. I keep getting reminded of stories. Things which happened long ago. I remember meeting this charming man once. Very handsome, really. If I remember correctly, his name was Clon Newell. He had a positively elegant white beard, and there was a hint of laughter behind his eyes. Vladimir and I were posing as private investigators. We were trying to track down a rogue agent who had stolen a great deal of money and murdered the female agent with whom he worked. Then the man went to the ground. Vladimir wanted to kill him personally. I don't think it had anything to do with righteous indignation. He might have been afraid that the fellow would eventually defect and damage some of our operations. Vladimir occasionally talked too much, and may have talked too much to this man. Anyway, this fellow Clon Newell was very well connected in the field of science fiction, involved with various conventions and what have you. We had only one hope of finding this rogue agent Vladimir wanted to kill. The fellow was a fan of English language science fiction. He'd always devoured every book and short story he could find. So, we reasoned that the man we sought would attend some of these conventions, if he could. We traveled all over the country and used the same story, basically, that the man we sought was responsible for some horrible crimes, and the family of two of his victims had hired us to help in the investigation. I did most of the talking, because my English was always more idiomatically correct than Vladimir's. What made me think of this man Clon was that before we left his office, he promised to stop by our hotel and let us know if any of his friends might be able to identify the photo. Vladimir didn't like my leaving the picture, but I did it. 2 days later, he called and said that he'd shown the photograph to some of his friends. They'd never seen the fellow we were looking for, but would keep an eye out for him. He wanted to bring back the picture. I agreed to meet this Clon Newell in the hotel bar. I bought him a drink for his being so nice. I mean, he didn't know who we were, and he thought he was helping us to track down some unspeakable villain. He wasn't far from right, because the man Vladimir and I were chasing had killed the female agent he worked with, then cut off our head and our hands, so there would be no means of identification through dental work or fingerprints.
Yuck!
I saw the American police autopsy photos. Yuck, indeed. So, I bought Clon Newell a drink in the hotel bar. It was just downstairs, so I didn't bother bringing a purse. He was very sweet about it. But he said, "I don't mean to be rude, but you said you're private detectives, you and your partner." I always think of private detectives carrying a gun. And he laughed. All I had carried into the bar was my cigarettes and my lighter and my room key. Vladimir was out. I was wearing this little sundress and sandals. "You couldn't possibly be wearing a gun, could you?" Clon asked me.
"Well, were you?"
We were finished with our drinks, and I did two things I've never done before or since. I kissed on the first date and flushed the gun, but not in that order.
What?
I looked around, then raised my dress so he could see my leg. I had my Walther PPKS in a thigh holster. His eyes almost popped out of his head, and then he started laughing. He was so sweet. I leaned over and kissed him on the cheek. So, my rather long answer to your question as to how well I'm armed? A Lancer copy of the SIG 226 in my bag, and a Lancer copy of the Seacamp DA 32 caliber in the waistband of my pants under my blouse. The balisong is strapped to my right calf, and there's an Executive Edge Grand penknife clipped to the band of my bra. And that's more or less it.
All I've got is the Beretta 92F in my purse. It's funny seeing Daddy
head over heels in love. I think it's rather sweet. Despite the relatively meager difference in your ages, you see your father as an older man. Even though you and I are about the same age, I see him as a contemporary. For you, he's a father. For me, well, you know how it was.
Are you happy for him?
Especially now. If the world ends with this volcanic vent or a nuclear war, well, I think it would be worse somehow if he were alone.
Paul Rubinstein could see the second pursuit car's passenger compartment with reasonable clarity under the bright moonlight, well aware that anyone in the woods through which he and Kroenberg moved could likely see him just as clearly should he move from concealment. And although the V-Stall had landed several minutes ago, and each second lost merely increased the possibility of the V-Stall's detection by Nazi forces, Paul Rubinstein could do little but wait. The moonlight was the critical factor. The pine trees here were particularly slender, and the second pursuit car was the Eden equivalent of a full-sized American automobile from before the night of the war. Although the car was damaged beyond drivability, it appeared the vehicle had effectively mowed a path into the woods as it went. Getting to the car in the moonlight would have necessitated full exposure to enemy fire. Moving any deeper into the woods would be dangerous because of the meager concealment provided by the trees and the almost non-existent cover. Cronenberg was about 5 yards back in the same predicament. Paul Rubinstein searched his mind for an answer. John's knowledge of small unit tactics was second to none. Over the time they'd worked together, Paul had picked up a good bit of that knowledge and experience, and more importantly, on the logical parameters which allowed effective tactical thinking. But he was at a loss. Cronenberg, on the other hand, was a trained military thinker, and in his earlier days, according to his Allied intelligence dossier, had been a commando of considerable ability. On knees and elbows, his submachine gun raised in front of him, Paul Rubinstein worked his way beneath the meager cover toward Cronenberg's position.
Cronenberg, you got any suggestions as to how we flush these guys out? Assuming they're not dead in the car there, without getting ourselves killed in the process? And don't forget, we're running on that V-Star's clock. I'm tapped out in the tactical department.
I thought you might never ask, Jew. We do, indeed, find ourselves faced with a dilemma. However, I think there is a way to circumvent our difficulties quite handily. Already having dismissed the idea of just riddling the car with bullets, because if the men inside are dead, it will serve no purpose, and it is dubious that they would remain inside were they not dead or incapacitated, and keeping in mind that firing would betray our positions, there is only one course of action. May I have your submachine gun, please?
Paul Rubinstein looked at Cronenberg for a very long second, then handed the gun over. Unraveling the V-necked sleeveless pullover sweater, which Cronenberg had worn beneath his tweed winter coat, they were able to get a long enough length of cord that Cronenberg's plan would have a chance at being tried. Bracing the Schmeisser in the notch of a tree, padding it with Paul's own gloves and Cronenberg's, then securing it with the extra pair of bootlaces Paul always carried, the gun was locked down. Working their way around the car while keeping some distance away from it, Paul Rubinstein and his unlikely ally were at a safely oblique angle to the submachine gun's cone of fire. And should the gun go wild, only 10 rounds were loaded in the magazine. With both of his Browning high-power 9mm again, Paul covered one side of the wooded area and the impromptu clearing made by the automobile, while Cronenberg, with his P-38, covered the other. There were blind spots, of course, but with any luck, if the personnel from the second pursuit car were still alive and able, there would be return fire when the Schmeisser opened up. Then there would be targets. Cronenberg, since the idea was his, had the honor of tugging on the multiple strands of yarn which had comprised his sweater, and now served as the tripwire for the Schmeisser's trigger. Once the trigger was pulled, then held back, the submachine gun would continue firing until the 10 rounds in the magazine were discharged. Cronenberg tapped Paul Rubinstein on the shoulder. Rubinstein nodded and waited. Paul Rubinstein held his breath, a high power in each hand as he waited for answering reports.
Now, Jew!
Fuck you!
A man ran from the trees, pistol raised.
Halt!
Cronenberg was beside Paul in the same instant.
You circle from the right!
Yes, of course.
Paul Rubinstein started forward toward the enemy position.
This one is dead, Jew. I recognize him. One of Dietrich Zimmer's agents, a fellow named Heedler.
Paul Rubinstein saw two other bodies. If they weren't dead, they were making award-winning performances.
Get Michael in here! A Darkwood!
Within a few minutes, Paul and Michael checked the bodies for papers or other intelligence data, finding little of interest, then making a cursory examination of the automobile, too. The car was clean except for supplies of ammunition, the modern equivalent of a thermos bottle filled with coffee, and other odds and ends. Paul Rubinstein and Michael Rourke exited the woods, starting across the field toward the waiting V-stall. They were nearly a half hour behind schedule, but the time could be made up. As they neared the aircraft, James Darkwood waited for them.
I checked out the first car and the guys near it. Not much intel value, but maybe it'll help in piecing something together.
Cronenberg inside?
Darkwood nodded. Paul started up into the fuselage. They left the adjoining door between their cabins open, and John was back in his own cabin, dressing. Emma Shaw, already into her flight suit, stood in the doorway, watching while John Rourke dressed.
Are you gonna get fat or anything?
After we're married? No. At least I hope not. How about you?
Only if you want me to. In a special way. But only for 9 months at a time,
John looked over his naked right shoulder and smiled at her, then pulled on a black knit shirt. He picked up his little .45s and slipped them into the shoulder holster as effortlessly as if it were nothing.
How long have you carried those guns that way, John?
About 632 years. Why do you ask?
Just nosy, that's all.
Lou Lessey was a friend of mine, you know.
That man who made the holster?
Yeah. You'd appreciate knowing that his product lasted better than 6 centuries and is still working.
Watching John arm was incredible. Anyone else would have been dwarfed by all the equipment, but not John Thomas Rourke. It wasn't that John was particularly large. He stood over 6 feet, his chest and arms well-developed, muscular, but not like those of a bodybuilder. It wasn't anything physical at all, although she thought he was incredibly handsome. But it was something from within him which made him almost more than human. He had 2 musette bags, and these he donned crossbody, from shoulder to opposing hip. The effect of the crossing straps reminiscent of the look of the old frontiersman in the days of flintlock and caplock rifles, like the powder horn and the ditty bag. The bags carried various necessities, as well as spare magazines for his rifle. John slipped into his battered brown leather bomber jacket, identical to the A-2, which was Navy issue to pilots. His was made from goatskin, hers from synth leather, the texture of the two substances identical. As he picked up his rifle, John turned to her and looked at her oddly.
You're staring at me.
Uh-huh.
Why?
You'd never understand.
Transglobal Alliance warplanes had, ever since the attack on the facility perpetrated by the Rourke family nearly 3 weeks earlier, pounded at the Himalayan Redoubt. Ordering commando raids in Hawaii, attacks on United States and other Transglobal Alliance personnel in every port to which he had access, Zimmer, Martin with him, flew to Eden City, where Martin would assume personal command of the Eden Defense Forces. All of the clones of the Rourke family were destroyed in the attack on the Himalayan Redoubt. The only clones remaining were those of Martin and himself, in storage within Eden City. More clones could be made, but years would be required to grow them to useful age. John Rourke, whom no one had actually seen personally during the raid, had won the round, but not the fight. And Rourke would never win that. Deep within the underground headquarters at the outskirts of Eden City itself, Dietrich Zimmer sat quietly and in relative darkness. Alone by choice, in order that nothing should distract him from the task at hand, he weighed the many variables confronting him. He and Martin, through the use of the remaining clones and the recording method he had perfected for downloading the brain onto the blank slate of a waiting clone's brain, could live for as long as the planet existed, and perhaps longer. As time progressed and his own wisdom grew, there was no way by which he could accurately gauge the potential for his mind. In centuries of learning, experimenting, growing, he could master what other men considered the prerogatives of a god. But none of this would be possible if he lost this war and were captured or killed. With the racial stock of the Rourkes to draw upon, he still possessed the cells from which he could again make their clones in any number that he wished. He could create the true master race, the dream of the ages. He had extracted as well the raw material required from the remains which John Rourke had so kindly helped him to obtain, the remains of Hitler. Dietrich Zimmer wished not at all to grow clones of the Führer. Any man who nurtured his own rival was madness incarnate. But with the appropriate genetic material, he could alter Martin, make Martin a god. All of this required time and breeding. Many decades, perhaps centuries. For the successful attainment of these goals, Dietrich Zimmer needed the opportunity to work, to experiment with human flesh and intelligence, something he could never do in a post-war environment in which he was the loser. He must first vanquish his enemies, and he had prepared for this ultimate contingency. While he had slept the sleep, he had ordered, constructed in the utmost secrecy, what, for lack of a better word, would be his retreat, should all else fail. Humanity had survived the near-total destruction of the species, mankind's number decimated only to be decimated again and again and again until the merest fragments of human population remained. Such could happen again, but under more controlled circumstances. For the sake of human perfection, a true master race of supreme beauty and intelligence, he would engineer the deaths of the rest. From the Rourke racial stock and the genetic material of Adolf Hitler, Dietrich Zimmer would at last bring to flower the true glory of mankind. He picked up the telephone receiver from the small table beside him.
This is Zimmer. Instruct the commander of my forces that I require his presence at once.
From the table, he took up the CD-ROM disk and inserted it into his laptop computer. He began calling up the data for Option Omega. Martin Zimmer was glad to be home in Eden. His father otherwise preoccupied, he could exercise his own interests. Vid surveillance devices were secreted everywhere about the city, allowing security personnel to randomly check for anything which might prove of a suspicious nature. The same monitoring allowed Martin Zimmer to indulge his dearest fantasy. Sex was only satisfying to him when it was as a part of rape. A handful of land pirates, all of them convicted killers and thieves, and themselves rapists, so egregious in these endeavors that despite his long-standing alliance with the land pirates, the men were prosecuted and sentenced to death, assisted him in his endeavors. The man he had appointed their leader was a big fellow with scars and a very ugly face. His name was Elder Watts. It was Elder Watts who stood before him now.
Did you get her?
Yes, sir. She didn't live alone, though. So we took the one she lived with for ourselves.
Martin shrugged his shoulders. There was no need to ask what had been done with this other woman. She would be murdered in the usual way, and he, Martin, would go on television and proclaim that Jewish fifth columnists working for the Transglobal Alliance had once again perpetrated another terror raid in Eden City. These Jewish fifth columnists were doubtless the same ones responsible for the dozens of other deaths in recent months in which young women were kidnapped, their families and friends killed, and their mutilated bodies later discovered in some field or by some roadside or in some alley. Martin Zimmer cared nothing for mutilation, but loved rape. After he was through with one of the girls, he would give her over to Elder Watts and the other land pirates in his employ. They used the girl as they chose, killing her when they were through, if she didn't die during their adventures with her. Elder Watts came up with the idea of mutilating the bodies, making the potential for propaganda against Jews and the Transglobal Alliance in general even greater. There were no Jews, of course, living in Eden, unless they had so cleverly disguised their ethnic backgrounds that they had escaped all Eden's best efforts to locate them. But there were Jews in Midwake, in Hawaii, in Australia, and elsewhere. Easy enough to make a conspiracy theory believable. Martin had spent the last 3 hours studying street video and made a selection for when he was through with this girl.
There's a blonde-haired one on one of these discs. Locate her. Be ready to take her in a few days. I'll let you know when.
What about this one, sir?
Have her brought to me in the usual way. I'll notify you when I'm through with her.
Right away.
Lidvelded Island had changed. However obvious it had been to him when he returned here for the first time after awakening from more than a century in cryogenic sleep, it was somehow more dramatic to him now. Despite the death of his son's wife, Madison, and their unborn child, and despite, too, the cataclysmic volcanism which had nearly destroyed the Hekla community, John Rourke had always considered Iceland a happy place. It was sad to come here with the death of all mankind imminent, and with a woman beside him, who had flown him here, with whom he would have liked to spend an eternity of life. He looked at Emma Shaw and smiled at her.
Why are you looking at me like that, John?
For very obvious reasons.
The president of Lidvelded Island was a man these days, Madame Jokli dead these many years. The quaint houses, like that of old Jan the Swordmaker, were all gone. The population here considerably increased. Neat, dormitory-like high-rise buildings replaced what had been here before. The central square, the park, and gardens were all replaced, and the V-stall which Emma had flown had landed there. A second V-stall U.S. fighter bomber had already landed, and John Rourke knew who had been aboard. The head of defense forces of Lidvelded Island and his aide, a carrot-haired young man seemingly just past his teens, were the only ones to meet them as they walked from the V-stall. Rourke glanced behind him once, Natalia and Annie walking a few paces behind them. Out of courtesy to the Icelandic Defense Forces, John Rourke had left his rifle in the V-stall, the musette bags stripped away as well as the gun belt. With his jacket zipped closed at the waist, he would appear unarmed. It was doubtful that anyone would think he was unarmed, but it was appearance that counted now.
Dr. General Rourke, on behalf of the President and people of Lidvelded Island, I bid you welcome.
The commander of the Defense Forces, General Stott, saluted.
On behalf of the other members of the Transglobal Alliance, sir, I heartily accept your welcome and offer my sincerest thanks for your hospitality as pertains to the forthcoming meeting.
Follow me, sir.
Certainly, sir.
Rourke fell in beside the general, Emma dropping off to walk beside the carrot-haired aide.
The anonymous visitor, your son-in-law, and Commander Darkwood wait in the conference center. Defense Force personnel are posted surrounding the building, but unobtrusively. Your discussions will not be disturbed. As prearranged, there are adequate sleeping quarters and appropriate facilities. Food and other refreshment are available should such be required. In short, all is as requested.
Your cooperation, General, is most appreciated. Although, as you know, these are secret talks, I will confide that upon their outcome, the eventual fate of the planet may well rest.
That is my understanding, Dr. General Rourke. So as few among the people of Liedvelded Island privy to this meeting taking place, pray for you all.
That is always appreciated, sir.
They reached the low steps of the conference center. It was part of the university complex. Rourke saw no security, but didn't look hard for evidence of it. He took the general at his word that all was as it should be. The general stopped at the base of the steps, nodding his head.
It is appointed that I should leave you here, Dr. General. But I am only a call away. Should anything be required, merely lift one of the telephones located at various places within the conference center, and you will be in touch with me instantly.
Thank you again, sir.
Rourke and his small group stopped just outside the conference room. James Darkwood was waiting for them.
We checked the building, Dr. Rourke. Everything is just as it should be. Cronenberg's inside. He and Paul are developing an interesting relationship. Cronenberg calls Paul Jew all the time, and Paul calls him Nazi. But they haven't tried to kill each other yet.
Well, he should like me.
What do you mean?
Cronenberg would fail to appreciate my ancestry, I suspect. I'll explain it later.
Any trouble?
Cronenberg even helped us. Some of Zimmer's intel people followed us, 2 carloads. Must have been following Cronenberg. Anyway, we neutralized them.
Permanently, I suppose?
Permanently, Doctor.
Rourke looked past Darkwood. There was a long conference table at the center of the room. On either side of it lay a sofa and 4 easy chairs, these covered in synth leather. On the right side of the doorway, as they entered, Rourke noticed a bar and various microwave appliances.
You checked those, that they aren't disguised transmitters?
Yes, sir.
Good.
Cronenberg sat on the couch to the right of the table. Paul and Michael, standing beside the conference table, began to walk across the room, Annie and Natalia going to meet them. John Rourke put his arm around Emma Shaw's waist and looked at James Darkwood.
I guess you get Cronenberg, James.
Very funny, Doctor.
Cronenberg stood up.
Dr. Rourke, whether you choose to believe me or not, I am honored to meet you, sir.
You're too kind.
Although he often took direct charge of strategic planning, he respected the mind of Reichsfuhrer Helmut Anton Grimm. But Dietrich Zimmer had not called Grimm to him for the purpose of eliciting either opinion or advice, merely to carry out the orders which were now the first phase in the modified Omega option.
Helmut, I have called you here in order that you might supervise something quite important.
Here was Dietrich Zimmer's personal office suite within the underground command bunker. Not so elaborately appointed as his accommodations within the Himalayan redoubt, the rooms were adequate. The fertile mind needed little of the creature comforts at any event.
I await your orders, my Führer.
You are aware, no doubt, that our scientists concur with those of the Transglobal Alliance in assessment of the sub-oceanic rift and the threat which it represents to the survival of the planet.
I am, my Führer.
Grimm was a little man, portly, what meager hair remained to him terribly thin, of lesser volume than the neatly trimmed mustache which adorned Grimm's upper lip.
I am determined that for the good of all mankind, you will personally contact the commander of Transglobal Alliance forces and volunteer the use of our tactical nuclear arsenal for the cause of the salvation of the human species.
My Führer,
I realize that you are charged with the defense of this regime and the defense of Eden, but I assure you that this act is in the final best interests of National Socialism.
Yes, my Führer!
Dietrich Zimmer began to outline what he wished Grimm to do. The girl had dark red hair, very pretty, and she was forced to her knees before him, her hands bound behind her. her ankles bound so that she could only take the very shortest of steps, and it would be impossible for her to stand on her own.
You may leave us now, Watts.
Elder Watts, grinning, his balding pate wrinkled at the brow, nodded and started toward the door of the special below-ground-level suite where Martin Zimmer entertained. Martin Zimmer walked over to the bed and sat down.
Tell me your name.
Mary?
Well, Mary, tell me what you think I'm about to do to you. And be honest with me, or it will go badly for you. Tell me, Mary.
Martin knew, and he knew that she knew, but it was so good to hear it coming from the girl's lips.
Hurt me.
You're very bright, Mary.
He stood up from the bed and walked over to where she knelt. The hurting would begin, but it would not end until well past dawn.